Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In seconds, we'll hear from Kelly Happy, who'll take a critical look at the uses and misuses of genetics. And at the bottom of the hour, the cultural critic Mark Deary will examine the personality and art of Edward Gorey. First, genes. They're everywhere, pressed into service to explain disease, temperament, family history, and even political leanings. We're now even attributing DNA to organizations, metaphorically, but the trope is revealing. How valid is all this? What does genetics explain, and what does it occlude? And why are we so obsessed with those little clumps of biomaterial? Here's Kelly Happy to explain. She's the author of The Material Gene, Gender, Race, and Heredity After the Human Genome Project from NYU Press. She's an associate professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Georgia. Kelly Happy. Genetics is really hot in popular culture, has been for a while. We've got, people doing their 23andMe all the time. We've got political scientists trying to find genes that determine whether one is liberal or conservative. Just as a generalization, what is it with this fascination with genetics? It's almost like people are trying to escape from history and politics and root things in genes.
Yes, and that's been a familiar critique by people like Richard Lewontin and Evelyn Fox Keller. For me, it's interesting to map out when some of these claims do gain traction in particular historical moments. One of the things I did was look at exactly when the Human Genome Project, when the ideas about that started gaining traction, and contextualizing that, situating at a particular time. Republican governments were drastically cutting back on social service programs, social services, and even going back to eugenics.
Yeah, well, let's go back to eugenics for a bit. In the early 20th century, that sort of thing was ubiquitous. Across the political spectrum, you had right-wing eugenicists with racist theories of human hierarchy, but you also had progressive people trying to use eugenics to improve the human population. The Nazis gave that a bad name, and genetics sort of disappeared, but what was that all about in the early 20th century? What was the obsession with genetics in a political and cultural sense?
It did have traction with progressives during the progressive era, in part because of new developments showing the role of recessive traits. It scared a lot of people to think that you could be unwittingly passing on undesirable traits because of the role of recessive genes. A lot of that had to do with rediscovering Mendel's P studies and thinking that some kind of social or cultural intervention needed to take place to take seriously this new development in science and biology. And so it did intersect with progressive era discourses. So there was this well-meaning, positive eugenics that will continue to work on the social cultural side of things in terms of policies and social services. But why not also advise people if there's a certain trait working its way through their family tree so that it can make enlightened marriage and reproductive decisions? That certainly intersected with a lot of racist beliefs, and that's why we have very much qualified histories now about someone like Margaret Sanger. But after World War I, that took a turn for the worse, and even worse because of increased anxiety after World War I and increased dislocation and demographic shifts and just the chaos of capitalism and the war. And that's when you started seeing in the 20s, not so much incentivizing certain people to reproduce, but criminalizing people for reproducing. And the passage of immigration laws were, of course, informed by this negative eugenics. When you read histories of eugenics, historians mention, often it seems to me in passing, that a lot of the eugenicists, not just the scientists, but the activists who are going around and collecting data and forming these eugenic societies, were professional middle class types. There was a way in which the middle class wanted to distinguish itself as not being part of the ruling class, who were certainly to blame, they said, for a lot of social problems and political problems, but also not identifying themselves with the poor, the working class, or the leftists, right? The communists, the radicals. Some of the history that I tell is through looking at mass marketed magazines at the turn of the century, pitched to middle class audiences, the professional managerial class, provided a kind of scientistic, nonpartisan view of not just diagnosing what our problems were, diagnosing it as biology and all these other things, not capitalism, but using science as a way to map out this center position, this non-political position of progress, what counts as progress.
In the 30s and 40s, the Rockefeller Foundation stepped in. This is an organization that has done a lot to shape our knowledge of the world. The Rockefeller Foundation stepped in and really began funding the field of molecular biology. How is this relevant to the story of this history of genetics?
Well, it was just another, I think, important moment in the history of genomics and where we are today, where you had a certain view that a scientistic approach to otherwise social problems would be the enlightened way to go about things, and certainly was informed by an idea that it's easier or more efficient to deal with biological defect than it would be to really take seriously what we might call the, you know, maldistribution of resources.
Which might lead to the expropriation of the Rockefellers.
Right.
The 30s into the early 40s were a time when capitalism was in deep disrepute and, you know, the New Deal was legitimating the state at a more mainstream level. But you had, you know, radicals on the left really questioning capitalism to a degree we haven't seen, at least until rather recently. The Rockefellers were interested in biologizing something rather than politicizing it, right?
Right. And not coincidentally, that was a time of a invigorated left. You can read this as biology, specifically genetics, as one way in which capitalism survives these crises, because it transfers what we understand to be the pathology that needs to be dealt with from capitalism to people's bodies, but also when we think about the way in which genes are racialized, certain bodies, of course.
Yeah, the racial stuff is very crucial. I want to get there in a moment, but now to the Human Genome Project. You talked a bit about that, but now what were the political environmental roots of the interest in mapping the human genome?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you look back, there were a lot of scientists at the time who were really against this and said, you know, this would just be an incredible use of resources to just come up with a sequence of what is really this inert, not terribly interesting part of human biology, this molecule. There was a lot of debate about whether that would be a good use of resources. And I have a lot of, you know, geneticists now that tell me absolutely in hindsight it was worth it because now you have this sequence has allowed for other discoveries and associations to speed up quite a bit. It provided a frame of reference. But still, it's still the case, though, that when it did end up meaning that a lot of people's careers and their scientific life meant being in a laboratory, just kind of mindlessly sequencing these 3 billion base pairs. And then as soon as it was done, it's always been rife with metaphors. But then the metaphor became, you know, we have this text, but we don't know what it means. And so now we have to get to the hard work of understanding what are the associations between the sequence and disease. And there's been a lot of revision of how many genes are actually in the genome. There's been a lot of revision of whether the so-called junk DNA is in fact junk or is meaningful. So it did seem to be at the time a kind of reassertion of the power of science to intervene at the level of the biological or the body as a way to take control over what seemed like uncontrollable social processes. There were scientists at the time, too, saying that the Human Genome Project could help us, you know, deal with mental illness. And, of course, this is at the time that the Reagan administration was simply defunding mental health institutions, and you found a lot of people suddenly homeless. And, you know, this is all happening in the 80s when the first idea for a human genome project started getting traction. So it just is another moment in that nature-nurture. Where are we going to decide where our ingenuity and power as a society, right, will be framed and acted upon?
Popular understanding of this is that genes are really determine everything. Like it's a map. And when people colloquially say it's in my DNA, DNA made me do it. The idea is that if you map this genome, you'll understand why some people are schizophrenic. You'll understand why some people have breast cancer. And then all these complicated social phenomena get reduced to, you know, this DNA mapping. But really, the relation between genes and outcome is far more complicated than that, right?
It is. One of the things that's interesting, the more I learned about DNA, was that it's acted on as much as it acts. There are all these variables in the cellular environment that will determine whether a gene is turned on or off, just to put it simply. There's a way in which the popular discourse around DNA hasn't at all caught up with the science. It is that very, even at the time that someone like Francis Crick was writing, just parts of what he had said about the so-called central dogma were understood later to be correct. And even he had said that there are probably going to be some exceptions to what I'm talking about in terms of everything being determined by the code, the so-called code. But there's still this, the way in which this idea that genes determine everything is still, as you say, is very popular, very part of the popular discourse around genes. It's very hard for the public to have a nuanced understanding of the relationship between genes and environment, and really to rethink that binary completely, because it's hard to even say that there are genes interacting with environments. It's all this very much complicated, contingent, evolving process. That complexity of human development gets completely lost in the popular misunderstanding that is a popular misunderstanding perpetuated by high-profile geneticists like Francis Collins. The working, you know, other geneticists kind of wish he would say, yeah, back at the time would stop saying the kinds of things that he was saying in order to, you know, to gain public funding and acceptance.
I'm speaking with Kelly Happy, author of The Material Gene. Genetics really has a hard time shaking its relationship with race. You know, a lot of the popular use is, I'm going to trace my ancestry through 23andMe, which always gets up to this very racialized field. Several months ago, there's an article in the New York Times by, was it David Reich? Is that his name?
Yes, yeah.
Arguing that, well, we know that race is a social construct that doesn't have any real biological basis. But then by the end of the article, he's basically saying that race really does have a biological basis, and it's meaningful, and pragmatism demands that we would pay attention to this. And so, you know, they're mapping disease, prostate cancer, for example, onto African genes and this sort of thing. What do we make of this?
One of the things that's important to keep in mind is that none of what he says in that op-ed means that race exists. It only means that ancestry exists. I actually don't know what to make of this insistence to say that what this research shows that when there's an overlap between self-reported race and actual genetic variants, that there, when there's an overlap there, that that means something like race exists. He doesn't need to use the word race. He doesn't even need to say his argument has anything to do with biological race. There is no such thing as biological race.
If they're just looking at the genes, they couldn't tell what race this person was, because there's just nothing there. The way they tell is by sitting across the table from you and noting by conventional observation, right?
Right. Well, even in earlier what they call genetic cluster studies, the geneticists said they did not know when they were running the genetic cluster analysis which of the samples identified with various racial and ethnic categories, understood social categorization. This is what led to the first op-ed in the New York Times that I had noticed and wrote about by someone named Armand Laroche. And if you look at the studies that he cited, however the tissue samples cluster is dependent on the number of clusters that you start out with. And so if you start out with four clusters, you are likely to see most of the samples cluster in terms of continent of origin, the four continents of origin. And that's because of, you know, if you look hard enough, you'll find some genetic variant that goes back to continent of origin. Of course, the problem with that is if you only choose, say, four clusters, all the tissue samples are going to cluster that way, and that's going to reproduce this idea of race. If you did the same kind of analysis using 14 different categories, you'd have a much more nuanced understanding of those people whose tissue samples were used could be described or understood in genetic terms. And then the other thing, there are always exceptions, and they don't talk about those. So it's not like every tissue sample clustered neatly into these categories understood in anachronistically as race, right? So continent becomes race in these studies. There's always exceptions, and for me, the exceptions disprove the rule. What happens to those people who don't fall into those racial categories? So what does all this mean for the practice of medicine? Even if a geneticist can say that somebody who identifies as African American is very likely to show African ancestry, what does that mean for medicine? Does that mean you racially profile people in medicine or not? Going back to the Reich op-ed, nothing of what he says means that race exists, only that there's ancestry and that may or may not be medically meaningful. In fact, his work on prostate example, I looked at one of his published studies, and what they showed was that for those persons self-identified as African American, they had 2.8% more African ancestry in this very particular part of their genome. And these were people with prostate cancer, and so they had more risk of prostate cancer probably because of these genetic variants. And what he's studying are very common genetic variants. We don't know if there's any real connection between that and prostate cancer. And one of the things that critics of biomedicine that use racial categories has said, people including Troy Duster and Jacqueline Stevens, is that you could find any kind of genetic variant that would be more likely to show up in one population over another. So I think it was Duster who said you could take everyone in New York City and find genetic variants that were more common to them than to other people. Stevens has said that you could probably find genetic variants that differ according to people's zip code. So the question goes back to, why does Reich and others want to use these genetic variant studies to prove that race exists? They would say, well, it's because there are these health disparities between blacks and whites in terms of breast cancer or prostate cancer. But again, the research is sloppy. We know that there are these health disparities. Whether there's a genetic component is debatable and medically questionable. We live in a racist society. And so if geneticists are going to be putting out claims like this, the stakes are high. It's even more important for us to look at breast cancer and prostate cancer as those places in biomedicine where race as a biological category is being reinvented and reappropriated. And that's, I think, quite dangerous.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about breast cancer. A lot of your book is about that, the BRCA mutations, which are associated with very high risk of breast cancer. But also, you know, the social roots or the environmental roots of breast cancer get marginalized if you're just looking at these mutations, right? I mean, you write something about the Long Island activists. Tell us about, you know, the politics of breast cancer in this context.
I've always looked at breast cancer from that perspective of it being an environmental disease as much as anything else, and being critical of genetics along those lines. A very generous figure would say that 5 to 10% of breast cancer is caused by mutations of either BRCA1 or BRCA2. I think it's definitely proven to be a distraction, even though it's still the case that probably less than 50% of breast cancer is explained by common and well-studied risk factors like diet and these sorts of things, and even genetics. There's still a way in which BRCA just keeps coming back as like the thing that's going to empower women, a way for us to make meaningful gains as far as breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. And I do want to allow for that. I mean, if genomics research can result in treatments that don't involve the scorched earth policy of either chemotherapy, radiation, or mastectomy, you know, I'm all for that. That's not, of course, what BRCA necessarily can allow for. Even though we've known about these mutations since the mid-90s, the options for women are exactly the same if you test positive for mutation that the clinician actually knows something about. So the risk varies. Someone like Angelina Jolie has a risk for breast cancer that's as high as 85% over her lifetime. Other women might have a 40% chance of getting breast cancer. So the risk varies, but the treatment, the so-called treatment options are the same. And we should note that we are treating risk, not breast cancer. But they involve, you know, more mammograms, more screening, preventive mastectomy, preventive oophorectomy, the removal of ovaries, and or starting to take cancer medicine. Meanwhile, most breast cancers are unexplained, which a lot of activists like the Long Island breast cancer activists have been trying for a very long time to raise awareness of the environmental contributions, the exposure to toxic chemicals. And there hasn't really, unfortunately, sadly, been a lot of progress since I started working on this.
The Long Island women were dismissed by the New York State Health Department, and also the CDC said they really couldn't find anything that supported their contentions about environmental causation, but they persisted. But if the experts say there's nothing there, what should we do?
Right. That's a problem of scientific methods. I think there probably was a lot of misplaced faith in the Long Island Breast Cancer Study Project. It's only as good as the methods it has. And even though it was designed in a way that was much, much better than previous studies where, you know, maybe researchers phoned some people and tried to make some kind of association between zip code and breast cancer risk. I mean, it was a very big study. It was an improvement in terms of how they were going about doing the research. It's still hard, very, very difficult to prove the connection between exposure to toxic chemicals and breast cancer. The body is a complicated organism, and there are all these different ways in which you're exposed, different ways in which you might expel toxins from your body over your lifetime. So it's a very difficult thing to try to prove. What's interesting, of course, is there are a lot of resources devoted to, say, doing the kind of research that David Reich is doing of finding all kinds of little genetic variables that are associated with risk, as opposed to a human genome project for epidemiology, where you have a massive amount of resources pooled and dedicated to improving our methods at understanding exactly how these processes work. There is also assumption that actually epidemiology is so sophisticated that when it comes to trying to understand breast cancer risk among African American women, you often see both epidemiologists and geneticists say things like, well, when we control for things like socioeconomic status and education and these sorts of things, there was still a difference. So it must be biological. My contention all along is we have a long way to go in epidemiology to really be able to control for those things before we start saying it must be something biological in African American women's bodies that account for these disparate rates.
And not that black people have a tough time in America.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, looking at this, you know, I started out wanting to put my faith in epidemiology because there are some great epidemiologists out there who are very socially conscious, who do understand the relationship between racism and breast cancer risk, and what the biological connection might be, like elevated glucocorticoid levels. It's still, unfortunately, the case that we understand breast cancer as a biomedical problem that at the end of the day, you're still going to treat biomedically instead of understanding housing policy, poverty policy, these sorts of things as public health policies, as breast cancer prevention. So it's one of the reasons I found the work of public health scholars who are also historians, like Merlin Trakwanyan, really helpful, because he shows that health disparities research coming from epidemiology simply restates the same thing, the observed differences, black-white differences in certain kinds of health outcomes these claims just keep adding up, and we're not actually making any progress. But if you take a historical perspective, a historical, even materialist perspective, you start thinking about how is it, you know, no more epidemiology. We just need to start actually making policy decisions that we're accountable for as our health disparities program.
You know, that would take us back to where we were yeah. 15 minutes ago, which means, you know, expropriating the Rockefellers.
Yes.
I was Kelly Happy, Associate Professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Georgia, and author of The Material Gene, Gender, Race, and Heredity After the Human Genome Project, published in 2013 by NYU Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the second movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 15, performed by the Takash Quartet. Next, a bit of an off-road detour from Behind the News, an interview with Mark Deary about his new biography of the artist and writer Edward Gorey. Gorey, who died in 2000, has long hovered between cult taste and the mass market. What's the source of his appeal? How did he come to be? And what lurks behind his enigmatic artifice? Mark Deary, who's been on Behind the News several times before, is a prolific cultural critic who's interested in a million things. His book about Gorey, Born to be Posthumous, is just out from Little Brown. Mark Deary.
And let's do the quick bio. He is originally from Chicago, the city of big shoulders, which is not the kind of place you associate with somebody as fabulous as he turned out to be. How did Chicago figure in the constructed persona that he came up
with? It's a great question, and I don't mean to reduce Gorey to an object of knowledge for queer theory, but as you point out, Chicago is known for a kind of pugnacious populism. Big burly shoulders, manual labor, it's Carl Sandburg mythologizes it and gives us the legendary language to talk about the persona of Chicago, but it's very much a pugnaciously proletarian town, at least in the American unconscious. I mean, obviously, it's got the Gold Coast, it has a rich and deep cultural legacy, it's got the Black Renaissance, you know, literary Renaissance of the 1920s is paralleling what's happening in Harlem, but it does have zero tolerance for inauthenticity, authenticity, affectation, and snobbery. And yet, Chicago, as I was told by one of the museum curators there, has a history of producing very odd ducks. And there are these various funk art movements in Chicago that are outsider art produced within the academy. They're very odd. They're very influenced by popular culture. So Gorey grows up in this milieu where, on the one hand, he's going to the Francis W. Parker Private School, which is a Deweyite school that's very progressive. It embraces a German-influenced, very progressive vision of everything for the child education. It's not at all top-down. It's not at all autocratic. And Gorey's biggest influence in high school is his art teacher, who's this Thomas Hart Benton-style, big-shouldered, macho, regionalist painter, who nonetheless is influenced by Parisian left-bank bohemianism. And although he's a fairly abysmal painter, what he does teach Joan Mitchell, later to become a leading abstract expressionist and Gorey's classmate, as well as Gorey, is that an artist must be an artist through and through, that persona matters, that you must look like an artist, act like an artist, as well as making art like an artist. And Gorey, sponge-like, omnivorous, and a lightning-quick study, picks this up right away. Fast forward to his senior year in high school, where he's caught walking down the main drag in Chicago barefoot with his toenails painted green. You know, this is 42, I want to say. So he's already learned the lesson that, you know.
Fabulous, ahead of his time.
Yeah.
So from there he goes to Harvard. And
well, from there he goes into the Army.
Oh, right, the Army. I always forget the Army. He goes to Harvard and then hangs out with quite an extraordinary crew like John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara. Like, tell us about his Harvard years.
Well, so on his high school application to Harvard for a scholarship at Harvard, he said, for whatever odd reason, I've always felt a kinship with New England. And he had relatives who, to use the WASP verb of choice, summered on the Cape and had ancestral roots in Barnstable, where Gorey later spent many, many of the summers of his life. But I believe that Gorey was drawn to New England because of the Hawthornian Gothic of it, the Puritan hangover. So the sort of morbid, you know, witch-haunted, guilt-soaked Puritan legacy, as well as the Henry Jamesian kind of Victorian atmosphere like Beacon Hill in Boston, really spoke to Gorey already, even in his senior year in high school. And so he was accepted to Harvard, and it was absolutely transformative for him. It's not so much that he metamorphosed into something entirely new, but it set in stone tendencies that were already aborning. So he'd been a very eccentric singleton, an odd duck only child, you know, who, let's remember, you know, is reading by the age of 3, he claims. And everyone who knew him at that age corroborates that. And by 5, has read Dracula and Frankenstein. Now, didn't claim to have understood every word, but there's abundant evidence that he toiled through them. And if you've ever read, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or Bram Stoker's Dracula, suffice it to say, most of us are stumbling through, you know, Little House on the Prairie at age 5. If we're lucky, some of us, Green Eggs and Ham. You know, it's not exactly 5-year-old reading. And by 7, Gorey is reading Henry James, you know, and he says, I have a distinct memory of being so riveted by it that my parents had to pry it out of my little fingers at the dinner table. Later on, he came to abominate James, and looking back on it, had no idea why he fell in love with James and said, oh, chloroform on the page, right? So he's already kind of an aesthete, even as an early child, but certainly by high school. And at Harvard, he's introduced to others like him, which is what happens in college, right? You meet the others. You may think you're the only one like yourself. You're one of a kind. You're sweet, generous. And then you realize that there are other bright bulbs and there are other very odd balls. And Gorey gravitated to both. And the first person that he met at Harvard who really galvanized him was Frank O'Hara. They were both Belletta Baines. They both had a taste for the waspish social satire of England in the 1920s, Ronald Furbank, Ivy Compton Burnett, who were both queer authors. At least we believe Compton Burnett was. She had what's called a Boston marriage, right? She lived with another woman, a famous interior decorator who wrote vastly on interior decoration. We don't know if they were a couple or if they were an item, but certainly they were roommates for their lives. Furbank was flamingly gay, and we can't help but wonder if Gorey, a quick study again, took some cues from him. He was famous for having, as they put it in the 1920s, lacquered nails. I forget who it was, perhaps Evelyn Waugh or W.H. Auden said, he was so 1890s in 1920 of Furbank. And that's what they love. That's what O'Hara and Gorey love. They love these. They were both Anglophiles. They were British authors of the 20s who were really trying to be Wildian 1890s aesthetes.
Gorey was not one to adhere to Ezra Pound's commandment to make it new.
I think he was, in a way. You have to remember that with Gorey, I'll mangle the quote, but he says something like, someone says, you're quite the macabre, aren't you? And he says, I can't abide that term. He says, I know it looks like that's what I'm about, but it isn't really what I'm about. So people will say that Gory is Rococo or Baroque, or he's certainly very arch, and he's highly aestheticized in the Wildean sense of embracing artifice. He's not about naturalism. He's about unnaturalism. That being said, Gory is paradoxical, and he's always, almost instantly, the opposite of what you presume. So in the same way that people say, well, he's all about this sort of Charles Adamsian Gothic, he's utterly unlike Adams. Adams has one trick, which is inverting bourgeois liberal gemütlich norms, right? And yet ratifying them. So like the Adams family is actually a very coherent social unit. They love each other. They're a stable family. And Gory is much more complex than that. One thing he's doing is using the language of the Victorian Gothic parodies or social satires of children's primers and morality tales, penny dreadfuls, shilling shockers. He's using that to ironize the 1950s. He's critiquing Eisenhower's America with this Edwardian Victorian vernacular. To your question, Gory is not modern, right? So you mentioned Pound, whose battle cry is make it new, right? I would argue that there is a very modernistic quality in Gory, which he may partly derive from Balanchine. The unbelievably laconic Apollonian austerity of Balanchine's ballets, no movement superfluous. You know, I do this analysis in the book where I compare Gory's draftsmanship to Balanchine's, and perhaps it's corny, but I suggest that Balanchine's sort of drawing on the air, and they talk about the Balanchine body. He reinvents the ballerina's body, which in the 19th century is stubby and squat and very Rubenesque and broad-hipped and thick-thighed, and he emphasizes these Jules Pfeiffer cartoon-like bodies with incredibly long, attenuated, you know, legs. And you can view the women almost as compasses describing parabolas or describing circles in the air, performing a kind of draftsmanship in thin air. And similarly, Gory, there's never a pen stroke out of place. And the writing, which is very much neglected, and I'm grateful to the Washington Post literary critic Michael Derda for pointing this out, he says, everyone is dazzled by the illustrations, and they're drawn to them, and they're distracted from the beauty of Gory's writing at its best, which at its very best, in books like The Object Lesson, Derda zeroes in on what he calls Gory's beautifully balanced periodic sentences, which every writer knows a periodic sentence is the sentence in which the most important word comes at the very end, right before the period. And the unbelievable narrative compression in Gory's almost Koan-like, because he does love Asian philosophy and he does love Zen Buddhism, the gnomic aperçus, the Wildean aphoristic quality, and the Zen Koan-like nature of his compressed writing, which also owes something to Ulippo, the French experimental movement, and surrealist poetry. All of that comes together to create a very modernistic compression.
I'm speaking with Mark Deary, author of Born to be Posthumous, The Eccentric Life and Mysterious Genius of Edward Gory.
The aesthetic and the psychology are very curious, in that personally he seemed very gay. His sensibility seems very gay in a classic sort of 20th century way, perhaps.
Right.
But there's really not much evidence that he had lovers. There's this chilliness and distance in him. And like, he's always evading a question, evading conclusions.
Yeah.
So let's psychoanalyze him here. What is it? Is he avoiding the gayness? Does it make him nervous? Is he avoiding any kind of passionate commitments? How do we think of this?
I was at great pains in the book not to be reductionist. And so while the question of Gory's sexuality can become a kind of gravity well that sucks all discourse down into its dish, and it's unquestionably a fascinating question. I don't shrink from it in the book, but neither do I want to reduce Gory's whole story and whole psychology to is he or isn't he? And I realize that's not what you're doing. But this is a question that has as many layers as a baklava. We can answer it on the psychobiographical level. We can also view his evasiveness, his circumspection, through the prism of what I would call sort of Derridean literary criticism. Gori was a great one for stepping out of binaries, right? Gori is famously said something like, I like things that are betwixt and between. And his interviews are riddled with comments like that. When he was asked about his sexuality, he said, well, I'm not much of anything, really. You can stereotype it as a gay man of the pre-Stonewall generation who was deeply closeted and uncomfortable with his own sexuality. You can psychobiographize it.
What is the glass closet? Do you use that phrase?
I use that phrase, and that's bequeathed to me by a very perspicacious blogger whose name eludes me at the moment, who did a blog. He did a blog devoted to queer subtext in popular culture, and he did very close readings of material culture, and he did some brilliant analyses of Gori's Anchor Doubleday book covers, some of which are really wear their homoeroticism on their sleeve. In fact,
the cover of Melville's Redburn
is hilarious. It's screamingly gay. Redburn is probably Melville's most obviously homoerotic novel, and Gori's cover shows three sailors on what appears to be a wharf. One of them seems to be clutching his abundantly swollen crotch. The other is sort of glancing in a furtive, sidelong way that we would call cruising. And in the foreground is a young man who's very pneumatic, firmly packed buttocks are facing us and are very obviously fetishized by the viewer's gaze. Provincetown Meat Market. You know, the obvious psychobiographical move would be to say, closeted gay man of a certain age, right, pre-Stonewall, uncomfortable with his sexuality and bound by his times to fly under radar cover, doing a deeper Freudian dive. You could excavate the quotes in the book from the few people he ever discussed his sexuality with very intimately, Andreas Brown and his dear friend from Harvard, Lawrence Osgood. And Osgood told me that Gori said, I tried it once, it wasn't to my taste. And that would be Gori's cucumber sandwich way of dismissing the subject and dodging the bullet. Osgood had the distinct impression that there was something traumatizing about the experience.
Trauma, I also thought about something traumatic with like that mixture of impaled babies and like whimsical names. Emotionally difficult material with a distancing layer of whimsy over it.
Gori's work is all about childhood and, you know, which invites the question, was his an unhappy childhood? He always claimed that it was perfectly sunny, that it was ridiculously normal. And he says, I'd like to think of myself as a palely loitering, you know, morbid sort of Wednesday Addams, as it were. And then my words, not his. But I was always out playing kick the can with the other kids. And it's true that he was perfectly popular and by all accounts a wonderfully well-adjusted child. But here's how we have to problematize or complexify Gori's sexuality. Part of that, I believe, is about his recoil from the embalming function of language. I mean, Gori really is at heart, you know, unwittingly, a post-structuralist and a postmodernist. He has a deep Samuel Beckettian and Jacques Derridean quarrel with language. He read Beckett and quite liked Beckett. I'm not aware that he ever read Derrida and probably would have found him insufferably pretentious. But he's Derridean instinctually because he detests the way language sticks a pin through the butterfly and kills it on the page. He wants ambiguity. That's where the richness and complexity of art and life come from. Gori leaves lacuna in his work, whether it's white spaces on the page, his wonderfully Asian in the sense of like Sumi Chinese brush painting and Hokusai's floating world. Gori uses blank spaces on the page and silence in language and elisions and wonderfully indicated things not said, and then also in terms of Hitchcockian and Jamesian, Henry Jamesian psychology, there are elisions in the kind of drawing room dramas of his work, which is to say eyes that never meet, knots of people clustered together, none of them looking at each other. Glances are always averted, or if people's eyes meet, they meet in a circumspect and surreptitious way. There are bumps under the carpet. As I always say of Gori, Freud believes in the return of the repressed. With Gori, the repressed stays repressed, but paradoxically, he's able to let you know that the repressed is there, repressed. You see the bump under the carpet, right? You hear the whisperings in the corridor late at night between the butler and the chambermaid. You can't quite make them out, but you know that the dark plottings are being conspired about. How does this relate to his sexuality? I would layer on top of everything we've said a kind of Derridian interpretation, which is the asexual is the sexuality that steps outside the binary. I mean, in our age of identity politics, we've never had more pronouns to choose from. But as Foucault would say, there's this kind of tyranny to the American need to confess. And what must be confessed is one's sexuality. So there's this idea that there's a hidden identity, you must ferret it out and publicly confess it, and then your identity is crystallized. Gori refused that. It's off the continuum altogether. It's not a type of sexuality, it's non-sexuality. And I think that there's something incredibly philosophically radical about that. Does it mask something else? Closeted homosexuality? The one thing we have to remember is Gori comes of age in the 1940s, was in the army, though he didn't go overseas, and that's a period when many straight men had gay experiences and then went back to their farms in Kansas or Indiana and never thought of themselves as gay. And what Edmund White points out, and I quote him in my book, is that young gay men who came of age in the 70s and 80s after Stonewall and during the AIDS crisis can't understand, as I believe people today cannot understand, your sexuality being the fundament of your identity. It was very common for gay men at Harvard and Gori's circle to be flamboyantly out, but to never state, "I am gay," because it was a secret hidden in plain sight.
Gori went from being this popular, but still a bit of a cult guy, to a degree of fame because of the PBS series Mystery, and then the illustrations for Old Possum's book of Practical Cats, Eliot's book, that provided him with a steady stream of royalty checks. So where is he now in the culture? What is his reputation, his role, and will he be remembered in the coming decades?
I hope he'll be remembered, and not being much given to false modesty, I'm hoping my book will play some small role in both installing him in the pantheon of gay letters and also American illustration. But as I like to say, you know him and may love him, but you likely don't know it. So if you like Tim Burton's twee gothic aesthetic, you know Gori. If you like Neil Gaiman's stop-motion animated film or novel, Coraline, you like Edward Gori. If you like Amanda Palmer and, you know, goth, dark, so-called dark cabaret, you like Edward Gori. So Gori's ironic, camp macabre, morbid whimsy sensibility has percolated into mass culture. You know, in his last year at Harvard, when he was getting anxious about what he would do to earn his daily crust when he left the, you know, intrauterine bubble of Harvard Square, he sent some of his cartoons and illustrations to the New Yorker, and I've read the rejection letter, which is at the Harry Ransom Center, and it's marvelous. It says, "Your people, we think, are too strange for our readership, and your jokes not funny." They advised him to normalize his work. Well, I mean, Gori had the last death rattle laugh, you know, when he dropped off the twig. You know, the New Yorker memorialized his passing with a full-page Gori illustration and his birth and death dates. In the run-up to his death, in the very last years of his life, they did Gori covers and hired him to do illustrations. So he lived to see the culture catch up with his sensibility, which, again, to push back very genially against your presumption that he is never modern. He's not only modern, but he's postmodern avant la lettre, as is Frank O'Hara, in his magpie gleanings from high and low culture, in his sense of history as a series of poses and styles, a kind of prop room and wardrobe to be raided. I think that's very postmodern, and I think that that sensibility, the sort of, you know, Edwardian, Victorian, inside ironic quotes, and the use of that, the presumably, although anyone who is historically literate knows this is a caricature, but the presumably priggish Victorian putting pantalettes on piano legs, you know, and Gorey uses all of that to talk about our historical moment. And I think that sensibility, you know, irony, and also kind of an interest in getting to grips with death in a way that America and its infantilism and its suspended adolescence has never been very mature about. Now there's the Good Death Society, and there's a lot of interest in death culture and in recuperating death from the funeral industry and retail, you know, mortuary outlets, and bringing death back into the house in into a Victorian way, preparing the body and so forth. That, I think, owes something to Gorey.
That was Mark Deary. His book, Born to be Posthumous, The Eccentric Life and Mysterious Genius of Edward Gorey, has just been published by Little Brown. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Return by Eno and Hyde. Till next week, bye.